Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Welcome back to another brand new season of the Global Development Primer podcast. I'm Professor Bob Hewish coming to you from Halifax, Nova Scotia. And today for this initial episode of this season, we're very happy to have Tim Pruitt join us to talk about world hunger issues. Tim is an international executive, CEO, and board member with more than 20 years of experience leading global teams to deliver impact at scale through agriculture and development, social enterprises, gender empowerment, impact investment, community-led development, and policy reform. He joined the Hunger Project as president and CEO on February 1st, 2021. Now, from 2012 to 2019, Tim served as CEO of International Development Enterprises with the belief that individuals and communities can lift themselves out of poverty. Now, IDE provides market-based solutions for millions of people living in extreme poverty in areas of gender, climate, nutrition, agriculture, water, sanitation, and finance. And IDE's social enterprises have measurably impacted more than 35 million people with agricultural technologies such as water filters, latrines, and drip irrigation kits. Now, as CEO of the Hunger Project, Tim developed and led IDE's strategy to reach 20 million people. And under his leadership, IDE redesigned institutional learning systems, expanded global staff, and increased diversity of IDE's board and staff. So we're very, very happy today to have Tim join us. He's also a Fulbright Fellow, holds an MBA from China Europe International Business School and a master's and bachelor's degrees in sociology from the New School and Lancaster University. And Tim's here today to talk to us about the Hunger Project. Tim, welcome to GDP.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
My pleasure. And just very exciting to have you join us for the first episode of this season. Because world hunger is something that is continuing to be one of the leading development challenges on the planet. It hasn't gone away. It's been talked about for decades, and we're still here with it. And when it comes to world hunger, the picture that's often drawn, and may I say often taught about in university and even high school, is the idea of burned up fields or a total lack of supply. But I'm guessing there's more to it.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you mentioned, we really should have solved this by now. I think for all of us that work in the space of hunger, food, nutrition, a lot of the challenges that we're faced with now, what we're seeing is an uptick, chronic hunger on the rise, increasing malnutrition, and challenges that, quite frankly, we should be done with. But the opposite is happening, and we're really struggling to meet the 2030 SDG goal of zero hunger. And so, yes, the images of hunger, we're talking about just not having enough food. And we know from the 80s and 90s, these images that we all carry in our mind about being hungry, you know, it's still there. There still are some basic calorie needs, but more common are disruptions to the food supply. So intermittent food that comes and goes. Malnutrition, which can be a little bit hidden sometimes. Sometimes it's not the classic image that we have in our minds about hunger. And then issues like an oversupply of calories, an oversupply of carbohydrate, and an undersupply of protein and micronutrients, which is leading to imbalance. And then on top of this are the global trends that we all know about, inflation, cost crunch. So we get a lot of communities that simply cannot afford a healthy, nutritious diet. There's about 3 billion people on the planet, according to the UN, that cannot afford a healthy, nutrition diet. We're only 8 billion people on the planet, so that percentage is pretty ugly.
Yeah.
And we all need to take action to reform our food systems and ensure healthy, nutritious food for all.
And I think the picture you're painting there is that this is, you know, when you look at the large numbers, 3 billion out of 8 billion, that's staggering. But that would also mean that these are individuals who are living with this problem, that they're closer to others than we think. It's not just a remote, isolated part of a developing nation. This is obviously impacting nations across the globe.
100%. Every country in the world is wrestling with this issue, and with few exceptions, it's becoming more of a challenge in almost every country. And yet there are bright spots. There are trends that are looking good, and we're seeing some groups come together and taking action. We're seeing more communities take action locally, which is exciting. As we all know, the global food system has tendencies and is moving in a direction of increased costs right now. But communities that are able to take responsibility and charge of their own hunger have seen remarkable results on both nutrition and overall calorie.
So are the issues then about losses with food production or distribution, or is it the way that we're consuming foodstuffs globally?
This is such a complex issue. It's because it's all those factors and more. So let's pull them apart one by one. Let's start with the food supply. Now, historically, we've done something really remarkable. We've produced an abundance of food on this planet. To think we are a population of 8 billion and that food supply serves the majority, inequitably, of course, and also there are serious problems, but still, it is remarkable that we're able to produce this much food on the planet. And the reason for this is due to science, technology, government, and of course, the world's farming and farm systems. And that the emphasis, the historical emphasis, has always been on producing more grains, corn, wheat, and rice in particular. And the scientific advances in those throughout the post-World War II era, you had the twin stroke engine, you had the combustible engine, you had the development of synthetic fertilizers, you had new and improved seeds. And suddenly, our farms were producing 4 and 5 times more grains than they were just a few years before. And that abundance of calories, corn, wheat, rice, has really led to where we are today. Mm-hmm. And that includes challenges with the environment. It includes challenges where the global food supply of shipping food around the world is so critical to hunger that, some countries simply don't produce enough calories and they need to import. Others have an abundance and ship it around. Right now, the Panama Canal, because of climate change, is having backlogs. The ships are stuck at port or in the area and they can't get through quickly enough. And that impacts the world's food supply. Same with the Black Sea grain deal coming out of Russia. We've seen food prices rise because of both of these issues. And we expect more disruptions on this global supply chain. That's just one of the issues that's there in today's food system. You mentioned consumption as well. You know, when you look at this from an Earth boundary point of view and say, what can our Earth hold? We can't continue the diets that we have today. We've got to make changes on that global level. Mm-hmm. And of course, eating meat, red meat, is a huge issue. There's a lot of consumption there of resources. There's the statistic that it would take 7 times the amount of grains to feed the animals that we then eat in animal agriculture. But there's also a lot of resources used on certain plants. Almonds are notorious for consuming huge amounts of water, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be increased understanding of our planetary boundaries and how we choose our diets. And more importantly, I think, when our governments put subsidies behind some of these things, it has to consider the planetary boundaries and healthy, nutritious food.
Yeah.
On that note, while we have this abundance of calories and protein in North America, if you look at many countries, there's a huge protein shortage. So they actually need to increase animal agriculture while living within planetary boundaries.
That's such a good question. Absolutely. Like, one of the things I'm just thinking that you're saying here, you know, with the use of red meat, I mean, it's now we're in an age of inflation and they're putting, you know, security tags on roast beef. So it doesn't, you know, just disappear out of the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Not many items in a grocery store have those tags, but now they're there.
Yeah.
That's telling. And I think someone has used the term like recreational red meat. Like it's not sitting down for a nice, you know, leg of lamb or something like this as a family setting. It's this quick on the go, highly processed stuff that has these upstream impacts. And when you mentioned that there's countries that don't have enough protein and they need to increase it, one of the areas I've been researching myself are heavily sanctioned nations. Mm. And you go to one and that's the first thing to depart off of the dinner plate. Is any sort of protein. And there you get into that distribution question where if you've got a nation that's under sanctions, there may be food around. It's often not getting to those who need it the most.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the real, I think that's the real tragedy here of our global food system is that we have an abundance of food. We have more than enough food to feed everybody on the planet a 2000 calorie day diet. It's imbalanced, of course, but it's there. The resources, we're expending them now to grow that food. And the distribution is off. And there's dozens reasons for that. At the end of the day, the more we can grow local, the more communities can take action within their own resources to solve this problem, the better. It's not 100% of the solution, but we've seen some remarkable community efforts where they've been able to grow healthy, nutritious foods in a way that they've been growing a long time, you know, less dependent upon fertilizer, less dependent upon chemical agriculture, and more towards being in harmony with the earth. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy to do. I mean, I think we all, especially, you know, sitting in I'm here in New York, it's easy to say, let's go organic. Let's, you know, that's great. The challenge is really feeding the world on that system, the regenerative agriculture system. It's not easy. This is, for me, when I look at food systems on this big global level, I just see puzzles. Puzzles where we need more protein here, we need less protein there. We need more subsidies for fruit and vegetables, so those get on the plates. We need more micronutrients across the board. And our food is becoming less nutritious, more processed, and we're seeing more and more challenges in doing it in a way that doesn't harm the earth. But you're absolutely right with red meat. It, you know, there's not a lot of support for it. I think a big part of that is quantities. It's okay to eat red meat in smaller quantities, but we've had it such that, you know, it's just in my country, of course, it's just readily available. It's very inexpensive. And one of the interesting things that's come up lately, I know the University of California, Davis has done a lot of work on this. They do true cost accounting for food. And this is to recognize that the cost beyond the kind of immediate economic costs and look at the cost to the resources and the environment and so many other aspects of it. Now, it's really, really hard to advance an idea like that when we're having more and more millions more people slip into chronic hunger because of food prices. Mm-hmm. You know, our we're seeing it here in the U.S. and Canada, of course, but also if you go to, for example, in Malawi, we saw the price of oil rise there, cooking oil rise there by four times.
Man.
This is really hard to reconcile on a food budget. And for families that are spending 70 or 80% of their income on food, that is very big news. They simply go to the market and they buy less food, end of story. And then they have very difficult choices to make at home. And then, of course, the numbers rise on the chronic hungry.
So taking this together, the way that we're seeing production, the consumption trends, the wastage that goes into it, we can say that at this point, the Las Vegas buffet is just not the way.
Yeah.
There's got to be more out there. So what is it that the Hunger Project does that you lead? What is the mandate of this project?
Yeah, great. I'd love to talk more about Vegas buffets too, but the Hunger Project, really a remarkable vision from 1977, of course, long before my time. A group of individuals stood up and said, this is unacceptable. The famine that we're seeing today in the world, the chronic hunger we're seeing today in the world, this is unacceptable and it does not have to be this way. And in those early days, we gathered 6 million signatures from around the world, every continent, of people that were saying, we call for the end of hunger and we are going to take action to make that a reality. And we're going to call upon policymakers in our respective countries and the UN to take action. And in fact, our team was responsible and integral to the process that developed the Millennium Development Goals at the turn of the century, which of course includes hunger and so many other worthwhile efforts. So what does the Hunger Project do? We're in 22 countries today, and our efforts are designed to solve the challenges of chronic hunger through a community-led and holistic approach. If your community does not have access to clean water, for example, then you cannot absorb the nutrients in food. You get diarrheal disease, and so you're still hungry. If you do not have access to maternal and child health, then we see issues of hunger on the rise. If you have a high incidence of child marriage, you see far more hunger in those communities. And finally, women leadership is absolutely critical to the puzzle. We know the data says very clearly that with women in charge, more of the community has access to healthy, nutritious food. So we work on all these issues in addition to looking at the issues of growing local, looking at what already grows in that environment in harmony with the earth, and helping farmers and communities to get where they need to go to end hunger. Ultimately, it's up to the community. And we have, for example, across the continent of Africa, we work in 9 countries. We have a demonstration model. And even with that demonstration model, we have more than 1 million people that are living in what we call a self-reliant epicenter. And that means they've gained access to all of this puzzle that helps them combat chronic hunger and so many other challenges that are faced today.
So are there some examples of this work? And I know you've done work in Uganda. Are there cases there that kind of stand out?
Yeah, absolutely. So, for example, I was there about 3 months ago and visited one of these self-reliant communities, and I was blown away by what I saw. The one woman farmer that I met, she was growing pumpkins on a mixed-use farm, and she was able to process it and sell it to her neighbors. And it was all locally grown, and it was all done in a way, like a typical farm, you know, you go in and there's like rows and rows of corn, right? Monocropping, which reduces biodiversity, which bleaches the soil, so you get soil problems. Her farm was a mixed-use farm. You walk in and it's among the trees, and there are other crops there too. And the different crops provide different nutrients into the soil, so the soil stays healthy as well. So we're just seeing some really remarkable examples of regenerative agriculture that are coming from the communities themselves. And once they have this vision for what they want to do, and once they start in to gather together the resources they need to make it happen, it's remarkable what those communities have gotten up to.
And are the goods that they're producing, are they for community consumption, or yeah, are they in a position to be sold to upper markets?
You know, we have some examples of communities growing for upper markets, especially things like cocoa. A lot of it is grown and consumed locally, which for a country like Uganda, they have a lot of food in Uganda. They grow quite a bit, but there's still also quite a bit of imports. And, you know, this is common among many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, where the import balance is such that the global prices really determine how much food people can afford. So when she grows local and brings that to her local market, that just means less calories are going to be bought from imports. And it's exciting to watch that expand.
It's great. I mean, it's also interesting that, you know, Uganda is in a state right now where, you know, conflict is kind of low. Those interruptions to global supply chains are also not any different than most other countries. There's no particular conflict or sanction that's standing in the way of that. So it seems like it's a really good opportunity to study what these impacts can be without too much other interference going on.
Yeah, 100%. We just started a new effort to support a community in the far north of Uganda where they had been living in UN refugee camps for 22 years. Wow. And yeah, right. I mean, really an unfortunate situation. The security situation was such that, you know, the young boys would be, you know, grabbed up as child soldiers, and the young women, I mean, horrible atrocities happening there. And the UN, did their job in providing shelter to people that needed it. And 22 years later, you just have a situation where this idea of self-reliance, this idea of, sorting out your challenges on your own with the resources you have, is somewhat out of reach. You're just used to the UN, you know, system, if you will. And we just cut the ribbon on that project. I am so excited to go back and to see our methodology work in a group of people that are so keen to get their life back, to go move back onto their lands, and to continue this next chapter of their lives with more resources to get done what they need to be done. And that's a great example of what the Hunger Project does best, is really to support communities as they articulate a vision for their future and work to get it done. It takes about seven to 10 years, we find.
And I'm sure that there are those who have tuned in. And I know, especially this time of year, there's all sorts of, shall we say, appetite for getting involved in projects and research and finding ways to learn more about these issues. So for those who are tuning in, if they're students, scholars, policymakers, generous donors, whoever they might be, how would you recommend people get involved with this work?
Yeah, great. Thanks for that. First and foremost, I love your podcast because you're reaching out to people, you know, across the world and with information that can be so helpful to transformative change. And the more we understand our global systems, food systems and other systems that create inequity, the more we can take action. So I just want to say thanks to the listeners here and hope that the information found on this podcast and your other podcasts are helpful to stimulating change around the world. I think that education is absolutely critical. And I'm thrilled that after, you know, decades of seeing hunger as famine and simply lack of calories, the UN has turned toward this food systems model, looking at the systems that are in place that create the inequities. And we just did a 2-year stock taking exercise in Rome and looked at where we've come. There is a lot of work to do. Systems change is challenging. I would encourage your listeners to take a deeper look at those systems and work toward transforming them. That can take place in a number of different ways. Here's what we look at. Here's what our African leaders, when we gathered them together in Addis, here's what they said they want to work on. First is food loss and food waste for our country, but food loss for them, which is often post-harvest and coming off the trees and the vines and the like. The second is really looking at conflict and how conflict creates inequity and what we can do around that issue. A third one is gender. We unfortunately have really taken a step back on gender, and that needs to be front and center with all this work. And then nutrition. Nutrition is something that more attention needs to be paid, more government policy needs to address. Instead of providing subsidies to grains, there should be more subsidies to fruit and veg, and looking at micronutrients and how micronutrients can help, especially women and young children, pregnant women and young children in particular can benefit from those things. So there's a whole set of issues that can be pushed on for policy. I think in the local area, I mean, the more you buy local, the more you support local farming, the better. I'm in New Jersey. We get some great local produce. I would say still probably 80 to 90% of our industrialized food system is how we get our food here at large. But that needle can be moved, and we can collectively push for more locally grown food and solutions. So that, I think, should remain front and center. And if you'd like to get involved and learn more about the Hunger Project, check out our website, thp.org. We do trips occasionally. We have an event every fall. And we have a lot of information and resources that could help folks as they're looking for the next step.
That's great, Tim. Thanks so much. And thanks for everyone for tuning in again to the first episode of this season. Like Tim says, education is a powerful tool. So if you are indeed a teacher or a university professor listening to this podcast, by all means, use it in your class, put it on your learning management system, or reach out to myself or Tim directly if you'd like us to speak more to your students about this. Tim, thanks so much for joining us on GDP. We look forward to chatting again. And you mentioned that you're doing trips. I feel like I need a vacation, so maybe I can join you on a Hunger Project trip sometime.
Fantastic. We're looking forward to going to Uganda next spring. So give me a shout. We'll see if you can get over there with us. It'd be great.